At your job, do you ever have to deal with a nose roller? How about a snub pulley? Well, if you're installing a new conveyor belt system, dealing with the different components can sound like you're speaking a foreign language. Luckily, you've got a team ready to help. Grainger's technical product specialists are fluent in maintenance, repair, and operations. So whenever you want to talk shop, just reach out. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It's a great time to save big on everything for your next project at Menards. Get free estimates fast on new energy-efficient windows from Jeld-Wen. Choose from vinyl or wood windows and customize the perfect size and unique features for your home. Save big on all Jeld-Wen windows today. View our entire selection of Jeld-Wen windows on Menards.com. Plus, the weekly flyer for other great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to the season finale of season one of True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Kevin Eustace, and today we're going to conclude our 10-episode look at the alleged so-called Marconi murders, where during the late 1980s, a group of high-profile scientists all committed suicide or, shall we say, died in unusual circumstances, accidental deaths, open verdicts, things like that. And as a final reiteration of the point of this podcast, we're looking at this entire narrative through the lens that these people did not commit suicide. We're taking on the theory that these people were murdered, okay? So we are not in any way, shape or form taking any sort of liberties with people who may well have taken their own lives. We're basically revising history and taking a look at a very commonly held theory that these people, who it would appear were going to be key players in Ronald Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative or the Star Wars program, were considered by someone, be it a government, be it a hidden hand, to be too dangerous to keep existing. They either knew too much or they learned too much. But either way, as we've covered on earlier episodes, the chances of this string of suicides all taking place over such a short period within such a select group of people is almost zero. And that's based on statistics around suicides. It's basically real-world information that zero comes from. It's not just hyperbole to try and make the podcast sound edgier. These are real figures. For anyone who doesn't know the backstory about why I'm looking at this case, it's because as a child, I watched a silent documentary on the Discovery Channel, which basically shown a series of news reports and images of these deaths. And it would have slides that came up in between, saying where they worked, how closely they were linked to this initiative, and how suspicious the deaths were. Can I find that documentary now? No. But I remember thinking even at the time, why isn't this more known? Why isn't this as big as JFK? We're talking about over 20 people who were apparently murdered because they took part in a government program. But still, 40 years on, we're expected to believe the official narrative regarding these deaths. Because if there's one thing we are, which we don't like to admit, is subservient to the government that we vote in. In fact, let's look a bit deeper, but not from me. I'm not a journalist. I'm not some sort of reporter. I'm just interested. So I'm going to call in ChatGPT and its voice model. And I've got its permission to do so. And let's ask it a quick question. Anne, can you let me know how many people are in further education in the UK?
In total, the number of people in both further and higher education is likely well over 4 million.
Okay, Anne, thank you. And from those 4 million, I take it you're aware of the Bullingdon Club photograph, which is of 10 people, all from Oxford University, three of which went on to high places of power in the government, one Chancellor of the Exchequer, and two Prime Ministers of the UK. Now, given the 4 million students we've just talked about, what would be the probability of me taking a group of 10 friends within that society and taking a photograph and three of them attaining the same levels of power?
In a purely statistical sense, the odds are so low that this outcome would be considered almost impossible under normal circumstances, highlighting just how unique and concentrated power can be within certain elite circles.
Thanks, Anne. She likes to be called Anne, by the way. So, there we go. Almost impossible. And if you're not aware of the Bullingdon Club photograph, I suggest you Google it. It's 10 individuals who are part of one of these elite clubs when you join a prestigious university. Now, you could argue, well, being a member of that university automatically puts you in a position where you're going to be offered things like positions in the political sphere. You're going to be pointed towards those directions. My point is, we're meant to live in a democracy, and in a democracy, I should be able to become Prime Minister. However, as Anne has just quite clearly pointed out, that's not going to happen. And the reason it's not going to happen is that within these free democracies that we are so proud of being part of, we're not part of a democracy at all. We get to choose from who they tell us to choose from. Now remember, Anne is ChatGPT. She has access to the full internet. There is no bias from me in that at all. Yet she is telling us that the Bullingdon Club photograph should not exist. Now we've finished our conversation with Anne, of course, but I wonder what she would make of, say, in America, somebody becoming a head of the CIA, then a president, and then his son becoming a president, such as in the Bush family. Now, that's not democracy, as far as I know it, anyway. That sounds more like some royal lineage. Let's look at the word democracy in terms of the dictionary definition. It states a system of government by the whole population or all eligible members of the state, typically through elected representatives. Now, in broader terms, it means if you're an eligible member of the state, which we all are in a free democratic society, then any one of us should be able to stand as one of those hopefully elected representatives. Do you honestly think we could do that? Or will we have a choice of Oxford and Cambridge educated people who have found their name on your voting slip through nothing but birthright and nepotism? And in the UK, there's been a long-held saying that the upper classes, or the ones who go to power, so to speak, say simply, give the working class football and alcohol, and they won't care what we get up to. And if that's ever been proven, it's been proven so in the last decade. The post-truth era, where we can have prime ministers and presidents lie to your face on national TV, and we have to accept it. Therefore, how this all ties back in is, given what we've just heard from a non-sentient genius machine, that a photograph should not exist that contains 10 people, three of which are in high office, two of which are former prime ministers, it's beyond the realms of possibility. Why is it so hard to believe that the government, or another government, or some sort of industrial espionage, wanted these scientists dead, and not only that, our own government wanted to cover it up? For me, that's a lot more believable than the Bullingdon Club statistics. You also may be aware, over recent weeks, I got into a bit of a legal tangle with someone or a group of people who put a challenge to me legally regarding this podcast. I needed to get a solicitor involved. They've now thankfully sorted it all out, but it took quite a while. It meant many of the recordings needed to go to them, and any future recordings also needed to go to them. I can't divulge the parties involved, but I will say my solicitor has said I'm allowed to say that he's not seen anything like this in his working life. I even confirmed with him that I could say the following sentence, which is this, and I put this in the initial podcast of my scripting just as an off-the-cuff remark. But when he read it, he circled it, sent it back and said, "Are you sure?" I said, "Tell me, am I sure?" And he waited a few days and said, "Yes, you're okay to say this." And all it is I wanted to say, "You think you live in a democracy? Think again. You're told what is the truth and you believe it. And why you believe it is because you have things like a cost of living crisis. They ensure that we have enough distractions that when anything major needs to be decided upon or could cause a ruction, we have a distraction. Be it a World Cup, be it a European final, be it some sort of discord in the streets. It is almost, in politics, like a magic trick. Normally, when you're watching the trick being performed, the actual sleight of hand has already taken place. And that is politics in 2024. The ball is already under the cup, and we're too busy watching the leader of the country swing around a few more cups, guessing which one the ball's under. It's already there. The plan is in motion. The plan is set. They know what's going to happen, and we're going to be introduced to it piece by piece. I once again want to remind you what I stated a few weeks back about the number of European countries that in their political manifestos have slowly and quietly slipped in the reintroduction of mandatory national service. So can I ask you why this isn't front page news, why the entirety of Europe, more or less, seems to be wanting to have an armed force of millions prepared to go to battle? And the key word is mandatory, not voluntary, mandatory. So don't be too surprised if in a few years' time, podcasts are not available. Anyway, we need to conclude this season. And if you're wondering why that 10-minute ramble about politics was relevant to the season, then you're missing the point. The entirety of this season is about politics. It's about the geopolitical landscape at the time in the late 80s, and it's about the relationships that were both forged and broken. And it also highlighted how even allies are out for their own aims. We've literally talked about how special agents in the UK have carte blanche to go out and commit torture and murder and never be held to account on the basis that the acts are carried out in the interests and safety of the country. The point is, it's not the country. It's the people who shouldn't exist in that photograph. It's their interests. You may recall, during the initial Russian conflict, Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister at the time, demanded that all UK firms pull out of Russia. He was then questioned about his wife's company and their stock holdings in Russia and why they've not been withdrawn. And of course, he avoided that question like the plague. But then again, like the democracy we live in, he was, I think, our third, maybe fourth, unelected prime minister at the time. So the next time somebody mentions having pride in living in a democratic country, maybe remind them what you've been promised is a milkshake shop with 1,000 flavours, and when you've arrived at the till, they've told you they only have chocolate or vanilla. And the actual truth is they've never stocked any other flavours. You do not live in a democracy. You never have, and you probably never will. You're told what they want you to know, or what they want you to believe. And they want you to believe that these over 20 scientists took their own lives. I'm Kev Eustace. This is the season finale of True Crime Tuesday. And this episode, we're going to title The Trouble with the Marconi Murders.
It's a great time to save big on everything for your next project at Menards. Get free estimates fast on new energy-efficient windows from Jeld-Wen. Choose from vinyl or wood windows and customize the perfect size and unique features for your home. Save big on all Jeld-Wen windows today. View our entire selection of Jeld-Wen windows on Menards.com. Plus, the weekly flyer for other great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
At Nutrafol, we don't just help your hair, we help your body grow it. Because it's never just about your hair. It can be your job, or your deodorant, or your lunch, or just normal life. That's why our whole body approach targets the key root causes of hair thinning. Discover your root causes and why we're the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement brand at Nutrafol.com. That's Nutrafol.com. These statements have not been approved by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease paid for by Nutraceutical Wellness, Inc.
Let's begin by taking a look at one of the most striking cases. Do you remember Professor Keith Bowden from our very first episode? The computer scientist whose expertise was invaluable to high-level defense projects. And he died in what was officially ruled as a drunk driving accident. But as we discussed, there were strong indicators, be it tampered tires and witness testimonies, that would suggest something far more sinister. Then of course we have Vimal Dajibai and Arshad Sharif, both brilliant engineers who met eerily similar fates. Tragic suicides in Bristol that defied logical explanation. Two very promising lives, both working on classified projects, suddenly taking unexpected journeys that ended in their suicides. The methods, the location, the timing, all too much of a coincidence. Or was there something or someone orchestrating these events from behind the scenes? And that's the entire point of this season. As we've ventured through these cases, one theme has consistently emerged: the sheer unlikelihood of these deaths being mere coincidence. Consider this: a series of professionals, all working on or linked to defense projects, meeting their ends in ways that were either bizarre or extraordinarily violent. A number of autoerotic asphyxiations, electrocution through dental fillings, high-speed car crashes into deserted buildings with a car packed full of petrol. These methods aren't just unusual, they are statistically rare. So how do we explain such a connection of bizarre deaths amongst a relatively small group of professionals? What are the chances that several individuals working in these highly sensitive roles would independently choose such obscure methods to end their own lives? And, even more troubling, why were their deaths all too often hastily classified as accidents or suicides, with very little appetite for deeper investigation by the authorities? We must ask ourselves, could there be a common thread linking these deaths? Theories, as we know and have discussed, abound. From state-sponsored assassinations meant to protect national secrets, to foreign intelligence services cleaning up loose ends. Could it be that these individuals stumbled upon something they weren't meant to see, or perhaps became liabilities to those who wanted to maintain the status quo, as we discussed in the Mad episode? Because don't forget the backdrop of the time, the geopolitical tensions of the Cold War. They were at their peak. And the SDI, or Strategic Defense Initiative, or Star Wars program, was a hotbed of innovation and anxiety. The paranoia, the secrecy, the stakes. These all certainly could have driven powers to take drastic measures? Or was it all, as we're led to believe, a series of unfortunate events? As we jump into the unsettling reality of these cases, one of the most jarring aspects is the glaring contradiction between the reactions of the families and the final verdicts handed down by authorities. Time and time again, we are seeing a pattern. A pattern where the families, who knew the victims intimately, express shock and disbelief at the official conclusions. These are families who lived alongside these individuals daily. They knew their routines, their habits, what would stress them out, their joys. Yet, often, they would be the last to be consulted, and their concerns would be the first to be dismissed. Take, for instance, again, Keith Bowden. His family vigorously contested the ruling that his death was the result of drunk driving. Those closest to him insisted that he was not a heavy drinker, and certainly not someone who would drive drunk. The idea that this respected academic, involved in cutting-edge defense projects, would suddenly lose control of his car due to alcohol consumption did not sit right with his loved ones. Yet, their voices were drowned out by a swift coroner report that cited a blood alcohol level above the legal limit. But what if that evidence was tampered with? What if the accident was staged? The scene all manipulated to fit the convenient narrative. Or again, we could look at Arshad Sharif. The death was ruled a suicide. His family, who had spoken to him days before, reported no signs of despair or suicidal thoughts. In fact, they described Sharif as optimistic, making plans for his future, no history of mental illness. Yet, despite these assurances, the authorities quickly closed the case as suicide. And, of course, let's not forget how he killed himself. This is the gentleman who tied a rope around his neck, around a tree, got in his car, and put his foot down on the accelerator. Or so we're told. The fact that police found an iron bar wedged on the accelerator somehow escapes the entire investigation. All the questions raised by his family, his sudden trip to Bristol, a place he had no connection to, this method of his death, they're all largely ignored, and the inquest failed to look at alternative scenarios, focusing instead on the most straightforward, yet suspiciously simplistic, explanation. Then we have perhaps the most haunting example, that of Jonathan Walsh, the young communications expert found dead in the Ivory Coast. The local police initially suspected foul play, but their findings were overshadowed by the UK authorities, who ruled it suicide. Walsh's family were adamant it was not suicide. They pointed out he'd recently been promoted, recently got engaged to be married, and he'd just made plans for a holiday. This verdict did not align with the man they knew. Happy, successful, forward-looking. But their protests were met with indifference, and the case was closed without further investigation. The UK coroner literally ignoring the Ivory Coast coroner, who stated he couldn't have killed himself by jumping out of a first floor window. He argued it was more likely the second floor window. Plus, he had bruises around the face that looked like he'd been in a fight. They even ignored that when they investigated the second story building, they found scrawled pencil messages on the walls from Jonathan saying he was being held captive against his will. None of this made the official UK coroner's report. Why? And believe me, if there ever was a rhetorical why, it would be that one. The contradictions don't stop with the family's account either. Time and time again, we've seen evidence that was either overlooked, dismissed, or conveniently ignored. For Vimal Dajibhai, for example, the investigation failed to thoroughly examine why he travelled to Bristol. There was no in-depth inquiry into his interactions in the days leading up to his death. No attempt to trace his movement or communications that might have provided context or revealed a hidden threat. And what about that strange cassette tape? The one found at the scene of Arshad Sharif's death. It was reported that the tape contained a message for his father, but the contents were never disclosed during the inquest. So why was this potentially crucial piece of evidence kept from public scrutiny? What secrets did it hold? And why were they suppressed? Then we have David Sands, who of course drove his car at high speed into an abandoned cafe, with his car loaded with gasoline. The official report says that Sands may have been suffering from an undiagnosed mental illness. However, this came off the back of no prior indications of any issues and the absence of a suicide note. More curiously, investigators didn't fully explore why Sands deviated from his usual route that day. Also, the car was found with its seatbelt fastened. That's a detail that's very rarely consistent with suicidal intent. Moreover, why the intensity of the fire? Why the need for the intensity of the fire? It was extraordinary. Killing yourself is one thing, but knowingly doing so that you can only be identified by your dental records is highly suspicious. And then, of course, we have, I was going to say my favourite, by God, I don't mean that in the way that's meant. I mean as in, are we really meant to believe these people took their own lives? I'm talking, of course, about John Ferry and Alistair Beckman, who both allegedly committed suicide using unusual and complex methods involving electrocution. Both men were found in circumstances that defied logic. Ferry, sitting calmly in a chair, with electrical wires attached to his dental fillings. And we discussed in that episode how that defies physics. And of course, Beckham, wrapped in electrical wires in his garden shed. Even experts have pointed out that the method of suicide in those two cases is extraordinarily rare. So rare, in fact, the likelihood of two people in the same industry within months of each other choosing that same method is close to nil. It's interesting, isn't it? When we start looking at statistics, things we assume are, oh, that's just happened. Actually, the chances of these things happening are close to zero. Yet these anomalies were brushed aside, with investigators failing to connect the dots or even consider foul play. So, throughout this series, we've looked at theories as to what might be happening here. So let's take another little review of those. So theory one, foreign assassinations, be them industrial or governmental. Let's start with the first big theory. The Cold War era was a time of intense rivalry, and the world's superpowers and espionage was as much a part of the arms race as weapons were. And in this environment, it's not hard to imagine that certain nations would go to extreme lengths to protect their technological secrets, or to sabotage those of their rivals. So could it be that the Marconi scientists were targeted by foreign operatives, either to stop them from completing their crucial defense projects or to eliminate them before they could even start? Consider this. Many of the Marconi victims were involved in cutting-edge technologies, ones with significant military applications, from radar systems to missile guidance technologies. These innovations were not just important, they were game changers. It's well within the realms of possibility that a foreign power maybe the Soviet Union or another nation, threatened by these advancements, would have wanted to ensure that these technologies never reached completion. Assassination, in this case, becomes a strategic move, a way to cripple a nation's defense capabilities by eliminating its top minds. But this theory doesn't just stop at governmental espionage. We must also consider the possibility of industrial assassinations. Foreign corporations or conglomerates looking to eliminate competition or steal intellectual property. You see, the defense industry is one hell of a lucrative one. And the stakes are incredibly high. We're talking billion-dollar contracts. If these scientists were on the verge of a breakthrough, the financial incentives to take them out would have been enormous. This could explain the targeted nature of the deaths. Remove the key individuals who held the most critical knowledge. But what about this timing? Because many of these deaths occurred during the periods of heightened tensions between East and West. And just as critical projects were reaching their final stages, could it be that these deaths were orchestrated to derail projects at the most crucial moments? Were the scientists killed because they knew too much, or because they were about to achieve something that would have altered the balance of power? A great distraction for a sleight of hand. We've mentioned on previous episodes how Thatcher's own government were against her supporting the SDI, Reagan's Star Wars program. The heightened tensions in the Cold War could have been a perfect backdrop for them to start bumping off their own people, basically nodding in agreement with Thatcher to her face, and then killing the top scientists that could do the work behind her back. And it's these internal assassinations we'll think of next. Could it be that these deaths are the result of operations carried out either by us or even our own allies? Agencies like the CIA, MI5 or MI6 are all well known for their covert operations, and they've certainly been involved in murky affairs before. But this theory suggests something even darker, that there's some hidden hand at work, an entity with more power than the one we see on TV as a government. Could these scientists have been silenced? Not by a foreign enemy, but by a shadow government. The one that operates behind the scenes to protect interests that go far beyond national security. We already know how lucrative war is. It was outgoing president himself, Eisenhower, who coined the phrase the military-industrial complex. And he told us all to beware of it. Because, as somebody else said, who I do forget, war is a racket. And again, I'm no reportive investigator nor journalist. Statistically, that claim, war is a racket, is true. Here's an interesting fact. At the start of World War I, the making of arms counted for around 1% of America's gross domestic product. By the end of World War II, it accounted for 40. Now, sadly, when we look at history and statistics, it's very often the case that a war of a major war, a world war, for example, takes place after a cost of living crisis, when a country needs to increase its GDP. And if you think about what happens to the losing country in the war, think Germany after World War II, when the Deutschmark was basically worthless. To the winner, the spoils is twofold. Firstly, you've increased your gross domestic product. Secondly, you've devalued your enemy's currency. And you've basically not only steadied your ship, you've provided it with buoyancy that will last until the next financial meltdown. At which point, there's only a few options on the table. And this is why it's a solid theory that within America itself, there were people who were trying to sabotage the SDI. Because in essence, Reagan's SDI would render nuclear warfare irrelevant. Nobody could have a nuclear weapon because America would have a system that would nullify the warhead in midair. Now, given the amount of money that America spends on defense, and believe me, it's unbelievable. For example, in 2019, if you added up every country on the globe's spending on defense, America took up around 47% of that. So, without the threat of a war, what's the need to invest in defense? Think absolutely cold and clinical on this one. If your entire business, your family's livelihood, depends on you being successful in the defense industry, war is good for you and your family. If a president comes out and says, "I'm going to design something that's going to make war much less likely," what you hear is, "I'm going to take the food out of your kids' mouths." Now, unfortunately, a lot of people high up in the American government also have shares or own companies in the defense sector. Indeed, the threat about the military-industrial complex and the fact it needs to be watched very carefully was more of a veiled threat about how it's not the government who dictate policy, especially regarding war. It's these people with the money who own the defenses. And as we touched on earlier, it's not just America. When Rishi Sunak was pressured about why his wife's company didn't pull out of Russia, and he avoided the question like the plague, it happens in the UK too. So maybe this special relationship that's often been talked about is this hidden hand. So is this shadow government one that looks after the interests of both the UK and the US? And was this shadow government the ones that orchestrated these deaths in order to maintain control? To protect secrets that would never see the light of day? And if so, what does that say about the world we live in? The very idea there could be an organization with the power to carry out such a coordinated campaign of assassinations without any public accountability, well, it's terrifying. But it's a theory we cannot dismiss, especially when we consider the chilling regularity and professionalism with which at least some of these deaths were carried out. Especially when we know, by law, special services in the UK have carte blanche to do what they feel they need to do, legal or not, as long as it's in the country's interest. Or should that be the interest of those people who shouldn't exist in the photograph? Finally, we should ask, why the rush? Why did so many key figures die in such a short burst of time? Between those 4 years of 85 to 89, over 20 individuals connected to Marconi Defence died in suspicious circumstances. That's not a coincidence, that's a pattern. And patterns like this suggest urgency. There was an urgent need to silence these individuals before they could reveal something. But what was that something? What had they uncovered that was so threatening, so potentially world-changing, it required a rapid, deadly response? Several of the deceased had, in their final days, expressed growing paranoia. They talked about being watched, feeling threatened, of having uncovered something they couldn't speak about. Some even confided in close friends and family they discovered something that could change the world. Something so significant it left them fearful for their lives. Rightly so, because one by one they were found dead. So what did they find? Was it new technology? Something that would tip the balance of power? Was it information? A secret that would expose corruption or covert operations? We don't know, but we do know the speed and efficiency of these deaths suggest that whoever was behind them simply could not afford to wait. They needed to act quickly before the truth came out. And in the process, they created a climate of fear amongst those who remained behind. a fear so intense, it drove most of them to silence. Which would have been what these people wanted, because these deaths were also not just silenced for what they knew, they were killed to send a message to others, those who might have been tempted to speak out. This rush to eliminate the scientists could have been a calculated move to instill fear, to show no one is beyond reach, and that any attempt to reveal the truth would be met with swift and fatal consequences. All of these theories, or each one individually, prevent a chilling possibility. But when we consider them together, they paint a world where the lines between friend and foe are blurred, where power is not wielded with any sort of pride and honesty, it's kept in the shadows, and where the truth is a dangerous commodity. The Marconi murders are not just a series of tragic deaths. They're a window into a world of secrecy, deception, and the length to which those in power will go to protect their interests, not yours. As we close the final chapter on our look at the Marconi murders, or the alleged Marconi murders, we're left with more questions than answers, which is what I thought when we began. But what we have uncovered is a tapestry of intrigue where the lines between truth and conspiracy blur together. The deaths we've examined over these 9 episodes highlight a disturbing pattern, one that suggests that the official narrative that we're given doesn't always align with reality. So where does that leave us? Perhaps the real story lies not in the deaths themselves, but in the context in which they occurred. The Cold War paranoia, the race for technological superiority, and those sacrifices made along the way, whether voluntary or coerced. And as we've seen, sometimes the most unsettling truths are those that remain hidden in plain sight. In the end, we're left to wonder, how many more secrets lie buried with those dead? And as we prepare for our next season, where we explore false flag operations and government-sanctioned deception, we must keep this question in mind. How far will those in power go to protect their interests? I want to thank each and every one of you for being part of your show, True Crime Tuesday. This season, we've took a look at the alleged Marconi murders, and next season, we're going to take a look at something which arguably is worse in terms of a governmental aspect, false flag operations. And these aren't going to be conspiratorial. These will be ones which are proven, documented fact. And if you're wondering how false flags become crime and where the whole crime element is of this crime podcast, I would say, what would you call somebody convincing you that you are in favour of butchering innocent people to death because of something that government has done to make you believe so? Would you be angry? Would you be upset? Would you think it's illegal? Yes, it would be all of those things. And that's where the crime comes in. So please hit that subscribe button and join me on Tuesday, September the 17th, for Season 2 of True Crime Tuesday, False Flags. Also, during this break in seasons, we've built a fantastic community over on Patreon. And over there, we have our own Patreon podcast, Cold Case, where, as the name implies, we take a look at some of the most infamous cold cases throughout history. D.B. Cooper, the Black Dahlia murder, Tupac Shakur, Biggie Smalls, even going into potential cold cases that were never investigated, such as the death of Jimi Hendrix. If you wish to become a member, head over to patreon.com/crimetuesday, where not only will you get access to that podcast, you'll also get all of these episodes on this feed, both ad-free and before anyone else. And yes, that goes for finales and debuts too. So both I and the members of Patreon would love to extend an exclusive invitation just for you. Head over to patreon.com/crimetuesday. And why not binge that back catalogue of cold cases whilst you await the start of Season 2 of True Crime Tuesday, False Flag, beginning Tuesday, September the 17th. And until then, stay safe and take care.
Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is pushing back against that tide. They make high-quality clothing for a summer wardrobe you'll love, all made right here in the USA. Support America's workers and get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, like Allo or Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret? With Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whatever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/try to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/try.